Okay, thank you for your patience. Hopefully, from next time on, this will not be a problem. So, we are talking about partition stories this week, and you have had a very small selection of stories to read, as well as a non-fictional piece of work from Urvashi Bhutalia. So just first, some background on the partition stories and on India's partition. I will be uploading the PowerPoint as well, so you can, you know, you don't need to note down details there. As you know, the Indian subcontinent gained independence from British colonial rule on the 15th of August, 1947. And we talked a bit about that and Nehru's speech on the eve of India's independence. But of course, one key fact about that moment of independence was also the fact that it was a profound paradox. It was a profound paradox because with independence came partition, the partitioning of India into India and Pakistan, or what was then known as West Pakistan and East Pakistan. Okay, so this is how the area got divided. Pakistan was split by the landmass of India into West Pakistan and East Pakistan. And of course, as some of you may know, East Pakistan further split from Pakistan and became Bangladesh in 1971. Okay, so I guess this is what I meant by the paradox of independence, is that with freedom came division. And Pakistan was announced just a day before independence on August 14th as a separate homeland for the subcontinent's Muslims. There's a long, very, very complex history behind this as to how it came to this that we don't have time to go into, and nor is it, I think, in the scope of this module. But I think some key facts can be noted. One is that partition was both a geographical separation. I mean, you have to begin to imagine that people who one day were living in the same country, right, on the next day, they had different countries that they were living in. And that's, you know, what Manto writes about in his short story, Toba Tek Singh. That it was all, it was both a geographical separation, but also had deep social and psychological effects. And it left indelible scars on the collective psyche. So much so that contemporary Indian politics and politics in the subcontinent in general is even now constantly referencing the event of the partition. Okay, a lot of communal tensions, religious tensions in contemporary India, when we now have a right-wing Hindu fascist party in power, the very history of its coming to power actually can go back to the partition, when tensions reached a peak between different religious groups. And in fact, until quite recently, there was no public commemoration of partition. That it was actually, remembering the partition happened within the spheres of people's homes and people's memories. But there was no public discussion of it. It was almost as if it was a taboo. And it was only a couple of years ago that the first Museum of Partition has been set up in the city of Amritsar in Punjab, where they are trying to collect commodities, letters, fragments of different things that people had to leave behind as they were fleeing their homes and collecting it into the space of a museum. And it's only in the last few years that there are projects of various archival collections, and of, there's been a spate of books about the partition, but it's actually still quite recent. Partition, however, has been a significant presence in the literature of the subcontinent, where it is figured often as a physical wound, but also as psychological trauma that was both unspeakable and unrepresentable, right? And that is how it became a challenge for literature, right? How do you write about trauma, and can trauma be ever represented, right? How do you put it in words? How do you write about trauma? Okay. Because, of course, for many people who experienced partition, particularly people who lived on the borders between India and Pakistan, partition was a severing literally of bodies, but also of the past, a severing of history and memory. Which is why the poet Faiz Ahmed Faiz, who's one of the most profound, one of the most influential, one of the most stunning writers of Urdu poetry of the 20th century, talked about the partition and talked about the very moment of independence as a mottled dawn, right? In his poem, Subah-e-Azadi, The Dawn of Freedom, he wrote, Ye daag daag ujala, ye shab ghazida seher, wo intezaar tha jiska, ye wo seher to nahi. This patchy light, this night-bitten dawn, this is not the dawn we had been waiting for. And because we've lost some time in the technical stuff, I won't show you, but there are lots of YouTube clips of Faiz reciting this poem, which is a poem of disappointment. Right, it's a poem of hopes lost, of hopes betrayed, at a moment in which there should have been euphoria and celebration. Instead, what you have is this patchy light, this night-bitten dawn. This is not the dawn we had been waiting for. Because, of course, partition was not just an official decree. It wasn't just an official announcement, which of course it was, but it unleashed a fury of violence between religious communities. Homes and villages were razed, uprooted and abandoned. People killed and maimed. Women abducted and raped. Families broken up and torn apart. Property looted and businesses and livelihood destroyed. It was destruction on a vast scale. Neighbors attacked neighbors, right? Because word went out that India was for Hindus and Pakistan was being created for Muslims, right? So you had Hindu neighbors driving out Muslims from India, Hindus being driven out of cities and towns and villages in what became Pakistan, and these typically had been neighbors. Again, this has been written about very movingly in a whole range of writings. Kushwant Singh's A Train to Pakistan, for instance, documents, it's a novel that documents the fleeing of Muslims from India. Friends turned against friends. Hindus and Sikhs were driven out of what became Pakistan, and Muslims driven out from many places in India. Although many survived and stayed on, many Muslims who believed, who agreed with the idea that India was going to be a secular nation, which is in the constitution of India, right, decided to stay back, which is why the film we'll see next week is really important, because it captures the dilemma of one such family. Although many survived and stayed on because, you know, as I said, India deemed itself to be a secular republic supporting the coexistence of all religions. As I said, there are many complex historical reasons for partition, the role of the British in communalizing Indian identities through what popularly became known as the divide and rule policy of colonialism, right, where you create trouble between different communities so that they cannot unite against colonial rule. And also the encouragement of the Muslim League to become representative of all Muslims, whether Muslims wanted a separate nation for themselves or not. The intransigence of the Indian National Congress that did not want to go into alliance with Muslim League. And also the power vacuum, right? In country after country when the colonial rulers have gone, and we see that in Africa as well, right? There was this power vacuum. Often they left without not much put in place, which was then filled in by violence, fueled by political opportunism, vested interests, etc. Now, the Muslim League first demanded Pakistan in 1946, but that demand was not based on a mass campaign. It wasn't that Muslims of the subcontinent were campaigning to get a different nation, right? That it became a kind of political issue and the partition came about. The death and destruction of the partition of India can be compared in magnitude to the world wars, in fact. 12 million people were displaced and they crossed borders. And 1 million people were killed in the communal fury and violence unleashed by the partition. About 25,000 women were raped and abducted. This is a huge issue connected to the partition, right? That it involved not only the killing of people in general, but the rape in particular of women. And not just by the other side, the so-called other side, although who was other, right? Often it was the neighbor, the friend, etc. But many women were also killed by family members for in the name of honor. Right, that before, you know, the women could be kidnapped by the enemy, so-called enemy, it was better to kill them, right? And of course, many committed suicide. There were many instances of women jumping into wells, for instance, and committing suicide before people who were out to get their families arrived. Okay, so it was a tragedy on many different levels, right? A national tragedy, but also something that played out within families. It tore families apart, as Urvashi Bhutalia's account also tells us. As I said in the opening remark I made, that partition's legacy is ongoing. And this is why I think it's important to kick the term off, you know, by thinking about the partition. And in order to do that, I think we can now turn to some of the texts to see how this catastrophic event was registered in both fiction and non-fiction, in film, in photographs, and so on, but also in history and memory. Okay? As some critics have argued, literature can be thought of as an alternative domain of collective memory, right? Which is why we see that even though officially there was no public discourse on the partition, right? Writers from the time of the partition have been very fascinated or disturbed by the event of the partition. Okay. Here are some images of the partition. In the first photograph on the left, you can see people have all their life's belongings, whatever they could gather on their heads, and they had to sometimes walk miles and miles. That's a typical image of a train carrying refugees from one place to another. The third image is the disturbing image of a body of water in which dead bodies have been thrown. Right? So you can see the ubiquity and the scale of violence in these images. So again, this is a very, very short list of a very long collection of writings which have appeared on the partition, from Faiz Ahmad Faiz's poem Freedom's Dawn to Saadat Hasan Manto's short stories, not just the ones you read for today, but others. Khushwant Singh's novel in English, The Train to Pakistan. Bhishan Sahni's novel in Hindi, Tamas. Bapsi Sidhwa's novel, Ice Candy Man, which was also made into a popular film. Atiya Hussain's Sunlight on a Broken Column. Across different languages, Hindi, Urdu, English, but also Bengali and other languages, there is, you know, a vast storehouse of writings on the partition. Several films have been made, both popular Bombay cinema on the partition, but also art house films like the one we will see next week, Garm Hawa, or Scorched Wind. The film Earth, which is based on Bapsi Sidhwa's novel. It's a film in English, so if you're interested, you can watch it. And very recently, a biopic on Saadat Hasan Manto called Manto, okay, which is, I think, also available on YouTube if you want to watch it. Okay. So I want to now begin with a few remarks on Urvashi Bhutalia's The Other Side of Silence and the extract from it that you read for today. So this particular text, Voices from the Partition of India, was published by a feminist publisher in India, Kali for Women. And of course, it is based on both Bhutalia's work as a historian, a feminist historian, but also as a kind of a family memoir, because Bhutalia's own family came from Lahore, which is now in Pakistan, and they were refugees from Pakistan to India. What is, I think, really important to note is that many of the stories in The Other Side of Silence are transcribed oral histories. Okay, so she actually went to people with tape recorders and asked them to try and remember their experience of the partition. Because, of course, there was no memorial for those who died in the partition, right? There's no official memory. Imagine having a country experience a catastrophe like that, where 1 million people died, right? And there's no public memorial. There's no marking of the million people who died in that violence. There's no recall, there's no public recall, except in family history and individual memory. Stories, Bhutalia seems to suggest, are all that people have. Stories that rarely breach the frontiers of family and religious community. And of course, I think it is important to keep in mind that on the one hand, stories are very emancipatory, right? If you're able to tell a story, You know, if you're able to talk about your trauma, it can be a kind of, you know, a kind of freedom from being, you know, shackled by that trauma. At the same time, storytelling can also be quite regressive politically, right? Because people may have memories, because memories are not always objective, right? So often someone's memory, right, of their sister, you know, being raped by a man of the opposite religion, right, it made them view that entire community, right, as a violent community, rather than as an individual incident in the larger scheme of things. So I think that there's that duality, you know, in memory, right, and that tension between history and memory. How can we get an objective account of what happened in the partition, right? And is literature the site of objectivity, right? What particular kind of insight can literature give us in terms of such profound violence as was experienced? As Buttaglia writes, history does not give you leave to forget so easily, right? So along with then history and memory is the third dimension, which is that of forgetting. Because in a way you can see that the state has deliberately tried to forget the event of the partition as if it did not happen, right? But history does not give us leave to forget, right? Because what has happened has happened. So what Buttaglia is really interested in is in the place of ordinary stories in history and their relationship to history, the grand narrative of history, and the ways in which individual stories are woven into the narrative of a nation. Right? So a nation both has a grand history, you know, a grand narrative that most every nation tells about itself. But within that are individual stories. And what is the relationship between the individual story and the grand narrative is what Buttaglia is interested in, as are the other writers. Another dimension of storytelling, I talked about two dimensions. One is that it can be a progressive, almost cathartic experience, right? You talk about your trauma and it can be cathartic. Right, you can get over that trauma in the telling of it. The other is that it can be regressive. Right, your memory may not be politically objective. Right, something happens to you, and therefore you infer, you know, blame. You confer blame on a whole community. But also that telling can repeat traumas. Right, so on the one hand, it can be cathartic. But if the stories are told over and over again, right, is it cathartic or is trauma constantly repeated? Okay. As Buttaglia writes, the selection of voices cannot even begin to map the history of 1.2 million people, the people who were affected by the partition, by the people who were killed. The bulk of that history will be lost. So with partition stories, there is a sense that stories have already been lost, right? That much as we try to now build a museum or have archives or conduct historical studies or turn to literature, this particular body of writing, right, of history in a way is already lost, because there's many of those people who experienced it are already dead. Right? They're dead and gone. Okay. So let's look at storytelling itself then in Buttaglia's text. She talks about the unspeakable violence that takes place and that she wants to give voice to narrate memories that lie on what she calls the other side of silence. So the silence on one side, and on the other side are the stories. The stories are told where the personal and private collide with the familial and the national. Right? There's a collision, there's an antagonism. My memory against other people's memories, against the nation's memory. Like many family stories, the partition story has been passed around. You know, in many, many families in India and Pakistan, you know, the older generation, right, you can often hear, ever since I can remember, or I can remember my grandmother saying this, or my great-grandmother saying this. There's a kind of everydayness, there's a kind of familiarity and familiality, right, in the way partition stories are told, simply because they often took place within the space of the family. Now, Bhutalia's is a first-person account. At the same time, as she writes, that it is a story too private to be told. Okay? And that's one of the threads throughout the book. What you've read is just an extract from a much longer book. The idea that a story might be too private to be told, right, so that in the telling, there's a kind of betrayal. There's a kind of betrayal of the self and betrayal of a certain kind of experience. So the question for Bhutalia, the feminist historian, for whose family this was also something that was experienced directly, is the question of whether to tell the story at all. Like a family secret, the partition as a family secret, which is also a national secret. Telling the story is an act of betrayal, right? To tell a story is to betray. And therein lies a constitutive contradiction, right, within partition stories, right? That it's important to tell those stories, but to tell those stories is to betray a secret, a family secret. I mean, often the secret could be that someone, you know, someone's mother or sister or daughter was raped and killed, you know. What is it to tell that story, right? How do you tell that story? How do you repeat that story? To speak or not to speak, then, is a moral and ethical choice, but also a narratorial imperative. The story must be told. But should it be told and how should it be told is a question that she's very interested in. How do we tell stories of violence, of extreme hate and prejudice? Okay. She writes about the fact that the historian's imperative is to tell those as a record, that these must be recorded. But as a secular Indian, it is also there is also the question of sense of responsibility. Because telling will open up old wounds, right? If you repeat stories of rape, abduction, murder, and looting, right? It has the danger of inflaming old wounds. In an interview, Bhutalia talked about the fact that when she set out to write her book, she believed that by telling these women's stories, she could liberate their voices. Yet it was only when I began talking to women that I discovered how wrong I was. She encountered a number of women who didn't want to be identified or who didn't want their stories to be told. Some of them had never told their own children about their past. When you tell other people's stories, you have to ask yourself, to whom are you responsible? Some abstract notion of history or to the people you interview, right? So very deep and profound questions about who do we tell the stories for, why, and to whom, right? And what social function are the stories going to fulfill? In another interview, Bhutalia talked about that she said that as a storyteller, you're in a position of power, she cautioned. And that as much as possible, you should try to show your interview subject what you will write. Many people will agree to tell their story, but when they see it in print, it has a very different impact. Bhutalia learned that breaking a silence doesn't necessarily lead to the liberation of a voice. And though that's one of the constitutive contradictions of oral history versus written history, right? Of history and memory, of speaking and silence, of home and nation, of borders and boundaries, that her piece explores. So in many ways, the imperative in her narrative is to keep silences alive, right? Especially when she goes to meet her uncle Rana, and the question about his faith, his vulnerability, right? So that to write about it is in a way to open up a secret. In other words, Bhutalia's account is a potent mix of memory and history, and it raises crucial questions about oral history as a legitimate record or evidence. And it raises questions about the status of testimony and the status of witness, right? Can we rely on someone? What is the status of experience, right? What is the status of someone who says, this was my experience, right? Do we take it at face value? How do we evaluate it? Those are important questions. There's also the paradox of home, of belonging and of not belonging. On page 25 in particular, you know, she looks at that question as she's standing outside Rana Mama, her mother's youngest brother, his home in Pakistan. Right? And then when she takes her mother back there, is a home that has been left decades ago still home? Or do people carry home with them? Is home something in the body and in memory? Or is it a physical space? The partition really raises that as an important question. The divide between the familiar and the unfamiliar, the private reconciliation and the public divide, how they are rendered incompatible is what she shows in the story. And that home, as much as it is the space of warmth and comfort and domesticity, is also made of borders and boundaries. We keep people out, right, and let some others in. It consists of frontiers and edges, of homecoming and home leaving. And finally, the idea of family and nation as connected categories. That families in the partition were, of course, divided because of national boundaries. So that the whole question of watan, which is the Urdu word for homeland or country, it's a difficult word to translate. It can mean home, country, land, all and any of them, becomes something inexpressible, some longing. It's more about a longing for a sense of place, of belonging, and of rootedness. Okay? So watan, land, blood, right? What takes her to this uncle is also the sense of a blood relationship. And what does that mean in terms of the violence that took place? Can blood relationships survive trauma? Can they survive partition? And so on. And of course, finally, the question of gendered violence. That this was violence that was not just violence among communities, right? But violence that was often directed towards women, where women came to bear the burden of representing their communities, right? Their religious groups. And questions of honor and shame, you know, became integral to the whole ideology behind partition. Moving on to Saadat Hasan Manto's Toba Tek Singh, which is one of the finest, Manto was one of the finest short story writers in Urdu, and one of the first generation of writers responding to the partition. In many ways, he was the writer who was best able to negotiate the perils of writing about the unspeakable at the level of language and aesthetics. The question of aesthetics is really important in Manto's work, as he uses satire and irony to talk about, to think about the outcast and the dispossessed. Toba Tek Singh assumes an objective tone that seeks to expose the lunacy of the idea of partition. There's a kind of double irony in the story, where partition is often dismissed in general as an aberration, as madness, so that responsibility for it can be denied, right? If we can say it was a momentary madness, then nobody is responsible. And the short story reflects upon the arbitrariness of the partition, the exchange of populace. And that arbitrariness is represented in the space of the lunatic asylum, right? Where the lunatic's broken, nonsensical utterances register the unfixable nature of language and of identity, right? As they break into gibberish. Identity is something that is up for grabs in the moment of the partition. And that whole space between nations, which has been turned into a no man's land, you know, becomes this kind of liminal space, you know, of Toba Tek Singh, which is why this marvelous line from the story, "I wish to live neither in Pakistan nor in India, I wish to live in a tree," right? The complete rejection of nationalism as an ideology, that nationalism divides, nationalism forces people to kill, to rape, to abduct, to loot, all in the name of some kind of pride and honor, right? So the protagonist here wants to reject that completely. There's also, so what the story really depicts is the absurdity of partition, of the nation as an arbitrary construct, yet an idea for which people are willing to kill and die, right? Similarly, in the short story Koldo, which is a very short story with its very spare and stark language, right, which makes the story even more disturbing, which represents the routinization of violence, particularly sexual violence, right? Where this man's abducted daughter is found and she's lying in a hospital. And as the doctor asks for the windows to be opened because she has been gang raped, right? She thinks that they're asking her to open her trousers. And when she hears the word "open it," she opens her trousers because, you know, she's in a daze. She, you know, her whole body has suffered that violence. And again, you see how Manto, in the sparest of language, can convey the most dire of images, right? Images of horrific violence, you know, are sort of focalized in his language. Similarly, in Kamleshwar's story, "Kitne Pakistan," "How Many Pakistans," written in 1966-67, which also shows the social upheavals of post-independence, you know, especially in the aftermath of the partition, in such that older forms of representation are no longer possible. Like Manto, Kamleshwar is, for him, experimentation was absolutely crucial. You know, similarly for Manto. Manto was an avant-garde writer for his times, right? Writing stories about the lunacy, the obscene forms of violence that he was witnessing in his time. Similarly with Kamleshwar, he spearheaded what was known as the New Story Movement, with its use of ironic distancing and of an understated tone coupled with stylistic excess. and you see that working out in the story. This use of very stark images which are juxtaposed with lush narratives. The aroma of the flowers and lingering memories, the emotional address and the tortured awareness, you know, of the characters. The story makes no explicit political commitment, even though it depicts a real conscious interest in the question of form. So the question of form and the question of politics, I think, are very, very central to thinking about partition stories, right? Buttalia thinks about it as a historian, and I think Kamleshwar and Manto's work make us think about fictional form and how stories of such extreme violence can be told. He too is interested in the repercussion of larger events in personal lives, right? As the protagonist says on page 17, it didn't matter whether or not I got Banno, what had to happen, happened. Right? So this sense of inevitability. What you see in the story are different manifestations of the same divide. The divide of the nation, the division of the body, the division of memory, the division of social relationships. So there's a kind of endless proliferation of division, amputation, and of separation. The idea of the loss of home, you know, as figured in the image of the dervish, the eternal wanderer, going back to the past, but the past is an ongoing one. Its reverberations are still being felt. What Kamleshwar does in his fiction, and Manto too, is that they break the past as some kind of a continuous narrative. It's chopped up. What is presented are imagistic flashes. Okay. The flowers come to represent the budding love between the protagonist and Banno. Okay. And here again, the question of gender, the gendering of partition. Banno in a brothel. She ends up in a brothel, right? And all of these stories end, therefore, with separation and distance between lovers and within families. And I think, lastly, the last point I want to reiterate is this question of dismemberment, right? It is both a political idea. It was both a political project of dismembering the nation. But it is also represented in different iterations of loss and of separation and of distance. And perhaps most profoundly in Kamleshwar's novel, it is represented in the fact that the narrator works in a factory of limbs that produces limbs for those who have lost them. His father's arms have been cut off. Right? So again, we come back to the idea that I started off with, which is that physical dismemberment, physical wounding in partition stories typically reflects a kind of psychic dismemberment and a psychic wounding. Okay, so I will conclude there. I had to rush a little because, of course, the time that we lost. But hopefully this won't happen next time and we can have a longer discussion. Okay.